This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Today we talk with Thomas DeGloma, an associate professor of sociology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His most recent book is Anonymous, The Performance of Hidden Identities, just out in 2023 from the University of Chicago Press. DeGloma is author of Seeing the Light, The Social Logic of Personal Discovery, and has co-edited two volumes, Interpreting Contentious Memory and the Oxford Handbook of Symbolic Interactionism. Tom specializes in the areas of culture, cognition, memory, symbolic interaction, and sociological theory. Our conversation was recorded on October 27th, 2023. I'm delighted to welcome you to the Annex, Tom, and thanks so much for writing a great book.
Well, thanks very much, Dan, for having me. I am thrilled to be here talking with you about the book.
All right. Well, now that I've read the book, Tom, I noticed the ubiquity of anonymity and pseudonymity, which is quite a word to say, in everyday life and, of course, in online contexts. The lessons of the book really unsettled me in a way that is rare, almost akin to when I read Berger and Luckman's Social Construction of Reality for the first time. So given that that was my reaction, and maybe I'm unique, but what did you hope changed for your readers as they journey with you in exploring the many dimensions of anonymity?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of different facets to this answer, but I think the main thing I would like readers to understand is that anonymity is a performance, that it comes into being when actors act in ways where they express themselves in ways that involve concealing their personal identities. So in the book, I focus on those sociological principles, and I take the position that anonymity and pseudonymity, you know, anonymity basically is acting with a concealed personal identity, and pseudonymity is doing the same thing, but using a very particular cover with a name or some sort of recognizable cover that you use that shields your personal identity. Anonymity and pseudonymity are always performances in which actors obscure their personal identities for particular audiences. So they're always bound in some way, contextually, situationally, relationally, interrelationally, and temporally over time. And those boundaries take different forms depending on the case you're analyzing, but these are bounded performances for particular audiences. And actors, when they're performing anonymously, they're using what I call in the book cover representations, which, you know, an ideal cover representation is a mask, but there's all kinds of means of obscuring personal identity, of masking personal identity. If we use that word mask more generally as a verb, to mask, you can use a variety of different technologies and means to obscure your personal identity when you're acting. And they do these things to convey information. Their performances are culturally significant. They make meaning as they act anonymously. And these meanings are often fundamental to what they do. I can just use a couple of examples here of somewhat famous cases in the realm of art and literature. Perhaps the most famous, really a pseudonymous artist in the world today, people often refer to him as anonymous, but he is pseudonymous, he uses a pseudonym, is Banksy. And one of the most famous authors in the world today is Elena Ferrante, again, another pseudonym. And there's all kinds of rampant speculation about who these people are. But these are individuals acting, and when they act, they obscure their personal identities with character performances. Their characters are elaborate, they're rich, they're well-developed cover representations that they use to frame all of their actions as artists and writers. In the process, they're doing all kinds of stuff that build up their personas as characters, right? They're cultivating intrigue. We tend to think of authors and artists and social movement leaders and others who are trying not to be discovered as very much intent on hiding. And they often are intent on hiding who they are, but there are positive consequences to this, especially when you're trying to sell product or become well known in your anonymity. You cultivate intrigue, that mystery builds speculation, it builds an audience. They're creating reputations. As much as Elena Ferrante sort of scorns public recognition as an author and argues that it will taint her art with some sort of, you know, negativity and make it less pure and seeks to sort of have this sort of purist connection to her literature, She has a huge following and a reputation as an author. It's just not under the name of whoever it is behind the cover. It's under the name of Elena Ferrante. And so they get this ego satisfaction. They just get it vicariously through the characters that they live, right? It's a vicarious ego and aggrandizement, I call it, in these particular cases where these actors have these characters that they build up and that they act with, and they're benefiting from it tremendously. And also an interesting thing to think about these particular cases, and again, I'm only drawing on them here to talk about why and how we can think of anonymity as a performance, is that they have segmented audiences. People often speak of Banksy, for example. Nobody knows who he is. Yeah, a lot of people know who he is. You know, he has a whole team. I had to interact with some of this team online to get permission to use an image. And so I was emailing with somebody from the Banksy team. People know who Banksy is. And then the performance is actually cultivated by this performance team for an international audience. So there's a lot of people who do not have access to the information about the personal identity behind the character, but there are some people who do. And the work to segment that audience is another interesting dynamic of the performative character of anonymity that we miss when we debate whether or not it's pure or fallible. We debate these technological measures, which are interesting to a limited degree. We miss all of this rich social and interactive stuff that goes on when people act anonymously, when they put on these performances. On another level, you know, in addition to that general point, that overarching point, as you know, Dan, I deal with a whole variety of different cases throughout the book, lots of very different cases, actually. And on some level, I'd like readers to come out with a richer understanding of those cases. You know, some of them I sort of flag and pass by very quickly as an example of the point I'm making, but others I delve into quite deeply in a condensed fashion, but deeply nonetheless. And I try to explore how anonymity takes form in particular contexts, situations, historical periods, scenarios. And I hope that readers are satisfied by that part of the book too. This, I guess, calls attention to my methodological approach, which I try to achieve a balance between a general sociological theory of anonymity and pseudonymity, but also at the same time, a deeper analysis of some particular cases that bring out the richness of these performances in different ways. And I hope that that balance is satisfying to the readers.
The Banksy example is really great because it does pull on this idea that these performances are obviously relational. It's a team effort in the case of Banksy. Obviously with Ferrante too, right? I mean, this person has to have some person that they talk to who is in the publishing world, or else their stuff doesn't get distributed. That's how it works. But I'm glad you bring up examples, because as you're saying, this is an extensive treatment of anonymity. It's full of concept. You examine generic forms that we use all the time in everyday speech, like someone, anyone, everyone. And I'm curious, how did you decide on the order of the chapters, and what guided you in selecting your examples? I just want to mention a really evocative one that connects to some stuff I was reading earlier. Jonathan Eig has a new biography of King, for example. And so one of your great examples is the way that the FBI sent Dr. King at least one anonymous letter suggesting that he commit suicide, or how the Bureau seeded mistrust and conflict among social movement organizations during COINTELPRO. So these are both very important as examples and in shaping our nation's history, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, these cover identities can be used to really shape how movement leaders operate, how movements interact with each other, or sort of parts of movements interact with each other. I mean, the FBI made it seem like their letter was from an anonymous Black man, which is super interesting, who they chose to be their cover identity. So can you talk about your selection of examples and the order of chapters for the book?
Sure, absolutely. I'll start with an interesting story. I'll get back into COINTELPRO after I sort of talk about the chapters and the cases. But I'll start with an interesting piece of information about the book, is that this book actually started as a paper in graduate school, my first semester in graduate school, in Evyatar Zerubbabel's classical theory course. Evyatar is a fantastic teacher and mentor who is also a great friend, and I am just endlessly inspired by him. But I started to become inspired by him my first semester of graduate school when he taught classical theory. And one of the ways he approached theory was to challenge challenge us to not adopt the voice of the theorist, not sort of emulate the theorist, but to be inspired by a theorist's perspective and ideas and write about whatever we wanted to write about using that perspective and those ideas and using it creatively and taking it wherever we wanted to take it. So in our section on Georg Simmel, I wrote a paper on anonymity. And that paper then, you know, Evyatar loved it. I loved it. It sat in a filing cabinet for 20 something years, and then it came out and turned into a book. But, you know, that sort of shows that the origins of my thinking about this concept were inspired by a formal sociology, a sociology that looks for commonalities among a diversity of cases that are underlying structural, interactive, relational, dynamic commonalities that exist at the level of the very general and not the particular. And that's how I was inspired to think about anonymity. When I was developing it, I had already sort of developed my methodological approach from there and other work that I had done in my book, Seeing the Light, and in other things that I've published. And I had published a paper in 2020. It was actually published as a book chapter in a really innovative book called Beyond the Case, a book about comparative ethnography. It was published by Oxford, and it was edited by Corey Abramson and Neil Gong. But the paper was called The Thematic Lens. And it was my attempt, working with my student, Max Papadontonakis, who was also inspired by this approach, to articulate this methodology that combines aspects of formal sociology, looking for commonalities among a variety of different cases at the underlying level of social structure, of relational structure, of interactionist structure, but also the elements of symbolic interactionism, how meanings are emergent in particular situations and contexts, and cultural sociology, how those meanings are often deeply rooted in the symbols and the, you know, other ways that we express meaning are often draw on the sort of deep elements of culture, then our actions are often very culturally meaningful. And so combining these three approaches into a study not focused on any one particular case, but on a theme. And so in this particular instance, anonymity is my theme. And then after that, my approach is to honestly cast as wide a net as possible to find as many cases as possible that conform to that theme. And by conform to the theme with regard to anonymity, I mean cases in which actors obscure their personal identities while acting. That's it. You know, I want to know when and where and how the personal identities of actors are obscured, how they achieve this. And I start to look at all of these different cases with a very broad and open mind. And different types of cases come to light throughout that sort of wide net process. Then I organize them according to sub-theme or according to other variables that might come out with my analysis of these different cases. I organize them and I focus on the ones that appear to be most interesting or illuminating to me. So the chapters, subversive anonymity, protective anonymity, the anonymity of social systems, the anonymity of types and categories, those came together as the major sub-themes that struck me when gathering and analyzing cases from a lot of different situations across historical contexts, from micro-interpersonal dynamics to macro-institutional dynamics, you know, a lot of different cases, gathering those cases over time, it became very clear to me that those social dimensions, again, protective, subversive, social institutions, social systems, and types and categories, those social dimensions struck me as the most fundamental. And so I started to organize my cases according to that structure. But it is very much a process of starting with the theme and then going after the cases. You know, this type of thing will make a statistician's skin crawl because they don't think with that logic. And statistics is great. It's not my cup of tea. It's great for what it does. If you want to look for trends and across variables across large populations, and you know, it's fantastic for making those kinds of arguments. But for a rich cultural analysis that transcends context and time and level of analysis, this is the type of sociology that can achieve that, a thematic focused sociology. For rich cultural analysis focused on one or two cases, that's ethnography. But for one that transcends many, many different cases and is inherently honed in on the theme, that's what I do. And that's what I do with the book. So the case of COINTELPRO comes up in the chapter on subversive anonymity. And for listeners who are unfamiliar, COINTELPRO is the term used to describe the American Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI's counterintelligence program. So counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, that was started under J. Edgar Hoover. And it was a program, a very broad but covert underground program organized by the FBI that was intended to disrupt political organizing, social movement activity in the United States. And it was going on from the 50s into the 60s and 70s, became very, very active in the 1960s and 70s. And their targets were, you know, widespread: the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, the American Indian movement, the Puerto Rican independence movement, and on and on and on. Most of their targets were left-wing progressive or radical groups. Some were right-wing groups, but most, the large majority, were left-wing progressive groups, and their intent was to disrupt, discredit. And I'm paraphrasing here. There's a quote that says this somewhere in their own words, but to disrupt, discredit, disorganize these movements, to really obliterate them through subversive tactics. It's interesting because it comes up in the chapter on subversive anonymity, where I'm looking at the ways that social movements use anonymity, social movements that mask themselves use anonymity to achieve their objectives. But this FBI program is the subversion of subversive activity. And the FBI used anonymity quite frequently in circulating anonymous leaflets, writing anonymous letters, acting anonymously in various ways to promote division among social movement activists, especially when targeting or trying to discredit social movement leaders. So the letter to Dr. King is interesting because of who he is and what a historically monumental figure he is in the civil rights movement and in American history. But it wasn't uncommon for them to do these things with all kinds of activists. And the letter written to him, you're absolutely right, it was intended to appear as if it was coming from an activist that was somehow connected to his inner circle, but somebody who was remaining anonymous. The letter was not signed, and it threatened King with exposing information on him and, you know, said, I have information. We know that you're immoral. We know this, we know that. And it was urging King to commit suicide as a way of avoiding a humiliation that was threatened. And, you know, whether or not the intent of the letter was actually to get King to commit suicide is debatable. The FBI probably likely didn't think that one letter was going to lead to that outcome. The way that I read COINTELPRO is in part inspired by my analysis of all of the documents, but also my experience as an activist who dealt with this in the 90s at Rutgers University, who dealt with the FBI tactics directly. Their intent is not never really directly what it appears to be. The real intent of that letter, and this gets back to the question of anonymity, was to sow dispute, sow disruption, create chaos, to foster speculation and paranoia. So, you know, the target reads the letter. If the target doesn't commit suicide, which is unlikely for someone to do from an anonymous letter, they're like, oh, this is never going to work. It's never going to happen, that this is going to have its intended outcome. But they start saying, who do we think wrote this letter, right? Who could it be? Right. Maybe it's so-and-so. I bet it's so-and-so. And the activist and the confidant sit down and they try to figure it out. At least that's what the FBI hopes. You know, some more savvy activists don't fall for this, but they start to feel like they can't trust other groups, or they can't trust certain people that they believe possibly could have written the letter, that they have to up their own protective measures, that they can't say things publicly anymore, that they can't have meetings with certain people present. It shapes behavior around paranoia. It cultivates paranoia, and it cultivates a sense of instability. And these feelings that come from being attacked anonymously end up doing things to social movement activists on a sort of social psychological level that changed the dynamics of the movement. At least that's what the intent is. So if it appears that the intent is for suicide, it's actually to sow disruption and disorganize by any means necessary. Another case that I write about in there was the anonymous flyer that they circulated with regard to the MOBI, the Mobilization to End the War in Vietnam Coalition. And it was a goose in mid-flight raping another goose. and it said Fly United question mark, and then it said balls, and it said it was a you know, very weird, but it looks like it comes from some activist, you know, trying to make a point. And it says, and it's critical of the leadership of the Socialist Workers Party and the Moby Coalition. So again, on the surface, it seems like the point is to criticize the Socialist Workers Party. But in effect, what counterintelligence work seeks to do is foster that speculation. Everybody is supposed to see that, and everybody's supposed to say, who the hell did this? Oh, I bet you it was so-and-so. No, it couldn't have been them. It has to be so-and-so. And so the meetings become a little bit more tense. People's eyes start to wander around the room to think, who could have published this? So-and-so is denying it, but they're lying, right? And so the mind starts to spin and the focus shifts to, you know, the saboteur among our ranks. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what the intent is there, is to create a cultural and political environment internal to the movement and the movement's relationship with other movements that leads to disunity and disruption. And they use anonymity to accomplish that, because anonymity is, on one level, inherently about mystery. It's inherently about discovery. It's inherently about speculation and wonder. But they use that to accomplish their counterintelligence program objectives.
This is amazing stuff to learn. I mean, you know, I don't know about you, but COINTELPRO wasn't covered in high school civics, at least no. not where I'm from. You mentioned your experience in movements at Rutgers. I think if you want to say more about that experience.
When I was an undergraduate at Rutgers, I was very committed to activism and organizing, and I was a part of this really wonderful, brilliant activist and community. And we had put a lot of work in with other groups to sort of form alliances among us, working with groups that are rooted in a variety of different communities, Black identified organizations, Latino Student Council, lesbian, gay, bisexual groups, and many others. And so we had this sort of previously established dialogue among different organizations within the progressive community. But at a certain point in our work, which was largely focused on public education, funding for public education, tuition reduction, really under the umbrella of the right to an education, the president at the time of Rutgers, his name was Fran Lawrence, said at a meeting that was recorded, and then the recording of the meeting was released, was leaked to the press. The president said, and this is paraphrasing here, but that African Americans did not do well on standardized tests because they were genetically inferior. So that was a statement made by the president of the State University of New Jersey and one of the largest public institutions on the East Coast. So this network of activists and organizers that we were a part of started to very rapidly, and under the leadership, I have to say, you know, and to say and to acknowledge here, under the leadership of the activists and organizers in the African American community at Rutgers, some of whom I still keep in touch with, and some of the other, you know, people from other groups that were involved in this, I still know today. But we started to organize widely around this, and the movement grew rapidly. The protests were massive. You know, we were used to speaking to rallies of 50 to 70 people, and all of a sudden there were thousands of people at our events, and at not my group's events, at the coalition's events, and in the streets and taking over highways. And it became a phenomenon that we worked very hard to not just make it about this individual, but to make it about institutional racism in higher education, and to make it very clear that institutional racism in higher education was also linked to the overall assault on public higher education and the attempt to reduce access to higher education by raising tuition, by eliminating certain programs and departments, by underfunding some things and overfunding others. And, you know, there was a whole way that our broad coalition articulated the connection between this racist statement and its environment. And because we had done that work, the movement didn't sort of flare up and die down like movements tend to do. It continued to grow for some time. It was getting bigger and bigger, and it was obvious that it was so big that the Secretary of State of the state of New Jersey invited a delegate. I was a part of this delegation of activists, student undergraduates, to come and speak with her about our demands. Like, that's how massive this thing was. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, there's a report that there was a pipe bomb left in the stacks at the library. And nobody knew about it. Nobody had seen it. I'm not doubting that it wasn't there. I'm not doubting that it was there. I'm just saying that it was a shock to everyone. And that very day, the FBI was on campus and they were very publicly and visibly there. They weren't circulating anonymous letters, but they did things like they would go to people's parents' homes, their grandparents' homes, their parents' workplaces, and they would say very openly, your son or daughter is wanted for questioning in connection to putting a pipe bomb in a library. And so the response that a lot of people very understandably had at the time was the FBI is trying to catch this criminal, this wacko who put a pipe bomb in the Douglas Library. And I know it's not me, but what if it's somebody I work with? I got to take a step back here because if I'm connected to somebody who could have possibly done this, that's not me. That's not why I'm in this. I do not want to have that affiliation. And so people started to retreat, you know, in mass. And, you know, looking back on it, you know, at the time it freaked all of us out, freaked me out. Looking back on it, their intent was never to catch a criminal. Their intent was to disrupt a movement. That's what they were doing. And I'm not going to go all the way and say that they're the ones that placed that device, but it wouldn't surprise me if it came out that they did. They certainly, at the very least, exploited that opportunity to create and promote fear and speculation among the movement rank and file and among the movement leadership about who could have possibly done this and why, and to have people become so afraid of it that it limited their willingness and their drive to be a part of this movement. And what was growing and growing and growing for weeks and weeks, all of a sudden, within a week, shrunk radically and became relatively ineffective because of people's fear. That was an experience that I had that you know, at first brought me to study Brian Glick's book, The War at Home, and to understand what was going on. And then when I started to study anonymity, it became an obvious case that I needed to address.
It's super fascinating example of, I mean, whether or not the FBI actually planted this pipe bomb, or if there ever was a pipe, you know, your point about exploitation. And then the fact that, you know, in the MLK case, this Ike biography I just mentioned, and shows that there were things that Dr. King did and relationships that he had outside of his marriage. And he wasn't a perfect person and by any stretch, and nobody is really.
Yeah.
But the fact that he was a minister, he had had relationships that were illicit and that he wanted to keep private from some people in his life. They were exploiting that through this letter and many other means.
Yeah.
Well, another great example, and I think it is a good a way of thinking about and just showing the formal sociology here, is your comparison a bit later in the book between the KKK and the internet hacker group Anonymous. And I had never put these two groups together. I mean, many, if you know Anonymous, they seem very different than the KKK in a lot of ways. But can you tell us about the concepts you employ in drawing this comparison and how it works in each case? And then I also was thinking about, as a University of Virginia graduate and somebody who cares about that place pretty deeply, what you made of the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in, I believe, 2017, where tiki torch wielding white supremacists didn't even bother to don masks when they invaded the grounds of the University of Virginia, but they did wear matching outfits that seemed to be geared towards de-individuation, you know, becoming just part of the crowd.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, I'll get back to that because I think that there's something very interesting about that spectacle there. But let me talk about the first question about Anonymous and the Ku Klux Klan. This is a part of, again, of the chapter on subversive anonymity. And, you know, I discuss a variety of different social movements throughout the book, all of whom practice some level of anonymity as a method, as a tactic, as a principle. And so, in addition to the hacker networks of Anonymous and the Ku Klux Klan, I discussed the Zapatistas, the EZLN, and the Guerrilla Girls, feminist artists, you know, activists, and others, Antifa groups that have as a common practice or as an ethic in some cases, the wearing of masks or the hiding or obscuring of personal identity. And Anonymous and the Klan were two that I focus in on in a particular section of the book. And I wanted to sort of engage in an in-depth analysis of both of these groups because their masks had become iconic. Like we recognize them now, and they've sort of become an iconic symbol of what these movements stood for and what they were, you know, what their ideologies are and what their activity involved. But yes, they're very, very different groups, incredibly different groups. And I say that all of the time when writing about them because I want to stress that their politics are different, their time frames are different, their objectives are different, the people participating in them, the technologies that they use are different. You know, they're different in every way, so much so that a comparison seems odd and out of place, right? And that's intriguing to me because they do have a set of general similarities that stem from their use of masks for subversive purposes. Again, this is a formal similarity. It's very generic. It has nothing to do with the particularities of either group. But because they use masks for subversive purposes, there are these commonalities that come out at this basic generic level. And this, therefore, is a great example of the power of a thematic lens and of formal sociology to see things that case studies can't see. You know, it's hard to imagine comparing these groups in the same breath, in the same set of pages, but there is room for that comparison. So one similarity, for example, is that in both cases, you see a very strong statement that the movement is a general idea rather than particular people. You see that with Anonymous. They express it very directly. It's inspired by the movie V for Vendetta. Actually, the original quote, "You can kill a person, but not an idea," is attributed to Medgar Evers, civil rights leader, but it was used in the V for Vendetta film when the head of the secret police is asking V, why won't he die? And he says, ideas are bulletproof, and you might be able to kill me or another person, but you can't kill an idea. Of course, V is an anonymous, really a pseudonymous person behind hiding behind a mask, covering his personal identity with a mask, which is a symbol that's adopted by Anonymous and other individuals on the left in the world today. And you see it also, this notion that the movement is a general idea in the notion of the Ku Klux Klan as an invisible empire, and in this notion that there are these immutable principles of the Ku Klux Klan that will never die. And the Klan articulated that in their literature and in a variety of different ways that I show in the book. There's also another interesting similarity that they both have origins in trickery and a dark comedic frame, which connects this to a sort of Bakhtinian analysis of carnival. That point might seem more obvious with regard to Anonymous, a group that emerged from hacker networks and 4chan, where the idea of humiliating somebody or exposing a target that is deemed legitimate creates this sense of satisfaction that's often expressed by the term lulz, LULZ or LOL. Did it for the lulz, or you expose somebody. There's this notion of trickery and dark comedy that underlies that form of activism and spurred the emergence, or was very common in the emergence of that form of a political network. But what is less known, and I think what comes out very clearly in the work of Elaine France Parsons and others, is that the original iteration of the Ku Klux Klan in the Reconstruction era, decades before the white hood and robes that we know today when we think of the Ku Klux Klan were a part of that movement, the Klan started as a lot of ex-Confederate soldiers and other Southerners dressing up in outfits that often involved Confederate memorabilia or old uniforms, sometimes women's clothing, sometimes the masks and the other costume features of carnival. And they would carnivalize these costumes and show up in the middle, in front of somebody's home or in the middle of a small community at midnight and build a massive bonfire and play music where they would ridicule through music freed Black Americans or Northerners who had relocated to the South. And they would do these skits in front of the fire where they would pretend to be Confederate soldiers returning from the grave. And one that's written about is, you know, the parched Confederate soldier returning from hell who can't satisfy their thirst and holds up gallons of water and pours them and pretends to be drinking large quantities of water. And, you know, it's beyond me how this might appear to be funny, but what some historians have shown is that it was framed as funny for a white audience. So it was framed as comedic carnivalesque skits for white audiences of the South while simultaneously being intended to terrorize Black Southerners, Black Americans, and white Northerners. It was often presented that way in the Southern Democratic press at the time. It was often presented as a carnivalesque type of event that happened. And this is of the Reconstruction era, right? Another similarity is that both groups use their masks to escape surveillance while surveilling their targets, creating the impression that their targets are always being watched or being exposed. I mean, that's what doxing is, right? Exposing, when an anonymous person exposes your information online for the world to see in a threatening manner, there's a surveillance aspect to that vigilante act, right? Both groups act, therefore, as voyeurs into the lives of their targets, right? They try to expose the lives of their targets in that way. In both cases, you have this really eerie similarity about how their masks became iconic. Both of them, the stories that led, and here I'm talking about the iconic masks are the Guy Fawkes mask for Anonymous, the mask from V for Vendetta, which most people today recognize. And then later, the Klan of the early 20th century, the iconic white pointy hood and robes. The emergence of these symbols happened because first there were books written. In the case of Anonymous, the book was V for Vendetta, published in 1982 by Alan Moore and David Lloyd, a graphic novel that was relatively obscure until the movie came out in 2006, which immensely popularized this narrative and this main character V. And then the mask from that film and the film's politics inspired hackers and others to adopt it as a tool for covering themselves, as a cover representation for politically subversive activity. In the case of the Ku Klux Klan, you had a series of novels, three novels in a trilogy written by Thomas Dixon Jr. One was called The Klansman, that was written in the early 20th century, and it was inspired by the Klan of the Reconstruction era, but written in there and published in early, very early 20th century. It was later, over a decade later, made into a film by D.W. Griffith. The film, of course, is The Birth of a Nation. Right. And the film radically popularized the characters and the cover representations that were depicted in the novel. The film inspired activists to adopt this symbolism. It might be weird for some to think of the Klan as activists, but that's what they were, an extreme right-wing terroristic social movement seeking to change the world, working against the power of the North to reconstruct the South, the power of the federal government in the 20th century to define equality and civil rights in the United States. They were fighting against that. And activists for that racist and terroristic cause adopted the symbolism from the film quite directly. And then in both cases, these masks start to be mass produced and distributed throughout the population. And there, you know, I have pamphlets that were used for KKK uniforms where you could mail order your uniform. You know, these were like popular sales distribution networks for the hoods and the cloaks, right? And just like today, the Guy Fawkes mask can be bought in, like, you know, shopping malls and certainly bought online, you know. And so you have this interesting similarity where in both cases the characters and the symbolism went from book to film to street, you know, and I find that remarkable how that formal pattern exists despite the differences. Both groups use mnemonic or historic references with their symbolism, and both groups create these general performative dramas of resistance while wearing their masks. And I think this gets us into that question that you raised about the tiki torch wielding right-wing extremists at the University of Virginia. It was a horrifying incident, which, you know, that event also led to a death of an activist and sort of marked the turning point in the popularity, I guess, of this alt-right movement. And I think that's significant because one of the things that you saw, and I'll try to draw another parallel here, and I honestly hadn't thought about this until you raised this question to me, but one of the things that you saw with the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s is that while the Klan was wearing hoods and terrorizing and killing and lynching and murdering people and wearing hoods in ritual activities where people's personal identities were concealed, you also had a very public, open Klan that would organize festivals and events and rallies. So there were these split performative fronts. And, you know, here I'm inspired by lots of work in the book, including, you know, sociology's very own Kathleen Blee, who is a fantastic scholar of social movements at the University of Pittsburgh and others. And the two fronts complemented each other to achieve Klan objectives. On the one hand, the subversive, masked, covered under the cover of darkness, cross-burning side of the Ku Klux Klan was the underground, terrorizing, ritualistic, mysterious side of that movement, whereas the popular front was like the raffle-holding, cotton candy-eating, public fair-hosting. You know, it seems odd to say that, but that's what the Klan was doing across the United States. It was a widespread populist movement. And that public front was a way of moving into the mainstream world as a method of recruitment, as a method of an attempt to normalize the position. And I think that on some level, you can make a parallel there to the events of the University of Virginia, where a number of racist today act in racist ways by obscuring their identities online. They might not be wearing hoods over their heads, but the internet offers plenty of forms where people can wear technological hoods over their heads, and they can obscure their personal identities with a pseudonym or just simply by acting in an anonymous forum. And when people gathered together without masks, it was a movement of that racist subculture, which existed before the events of the University of Virginia and was coordinating before the events in semi-private secluded spaces, either in person or online. It was a movement from those semi-private and secluded spaces, some of which involved anonymous activity, into the public sphere, a sort of coming out as a way of broadening the impact, as a way of making a public claim to the ideas that were previously publicly disavowed and privately embraced. And so I think you saw the Klan doing that in a much more developed way than happened at the University of Virginia in the 1920s. But I think that that's what's been developing with regard to the terroristic racist right in the United States ever since the election of Donald Trump, actually. And we hopefully will not continue to see it, but I fear that we might.
Your comparison makes a lot of sense. And in some other research I've done, we've looked at the popularity of the Klan. And as you were saying, fairs and festivals and things, you know, I think it was in 1920 that there was a Klan day at the Texas State Fair.
Yeah.
Talk about a vision of Americana, but a particularly white version of Americana,
yeah,
right? And protecting and the idea, yeah, white. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, anti-Semitic and anti-Catholic vision of America and the way that normalizing membership, there were leaders in the communities that were in that organization. And it wasn't just, it was also big cities as well. But it just strikes me, you can find advertisements for Klan Day online.
In the newspapers,
The Texas State Fair. Yeah, in the newspapers. And just, so that's how sort of ubiquitous this organization was and kind of just speaks to the ordinariness of white supremacy in that time. And obviously we're seeing echoes of that today.
And, you know, there were certain people who were sort of becoming public with their positions as sort of, I don't know, emissaries for the radical right back then. And several of them became quite popular. And I think that was part of that phenomenon too. They were sort of becoming public. They were vying for recognition as public spokespeople of a very deep network that was private. And there were lots of people who weren't public with their personal identities, but some people were becoming public as a way of sort of pushing into the public sphere and trying to normalize these ideas more.
Right. Well, I want to ask about the process of writing the book. Yeah. So tell us about that. What did you expect? How did it turn out?
Yeah. So the process of writing the book, and I want to say this particularly for the benefit of some of the more junior scholars out there, graduate students writing dissertations, assistant professors writing first books, is, you know, it was hard. It was a struggle. It would be very, you know, I don't know, possibly opportunistic of me to come out here and say, oh, you know, it was a pleasure. You know, I loved it intellectually. I will be honest and say that intellectually, it was a fantastic journey. But on a variety of different levels, it was a difficult enterprise, like I think all books are. And I entered into I was fortunate enough to have a year-long sabbatical, 2019 to 2020, partially because I had just done an enormous amount of service for my college. I was the chair of the Hunter College Senate for 3 years, which was a huge job. It's a large and strong Senate with lots of responsibilities. And so I had a year-long sabbatical, and I thought to myself, because I had this paper I had written, because I was so fascinated by the topic, because I had a mental map of what I was going to do, and I had gathered a bunch of cases while I was chairing the Senate and doing all this administrative work. I had some really great research assistants that helped me to gather some data on the cases I wanted to write about, and some literature. And I had a lot of this prep work done. I was thinking to myself, this book is going to write itself, and it's going to be a pleasure. It's going to come out in a year, and blah, blah, blah. And so one of the things that happened in the middle of my sabbatical is the pandemic hit. And then I had my whole family home 24/7. You know, it's funny. I used to half jokingly say that my life didn't change so much because I was like a reclusive scholar sitting at home and working all day anyway. But the main way that it changed is that the rest of my family was now home, including a 3-year-old. And so there was that. And that was tough on all of us. And that was, you know, tough on some people more, much more so than it was on me. I have to be clear about. But it was also hard because, and anxiety provoking, because as I was making progress on the book, the project was growing. So I would make some progress in the work that I wanted to do. But part of the benefit of the progress every time was that the project expanded in my mind. Every time I started to gain by analyzing something and understanding something on a deeper level, it became apparent to me that 3 other doors needed to open, that I needed to do 3 or 4 or 5 other things, right? And it's interesting. What have we talked about today? We talked about Anonymous. We talked about the Ku Klux Klan. We've talked about COINTELPRO. We talked about Banksy. We talked about Elena Ferrante. In the book, those are 5 different cases. Each one of those cases is a couple of pages in the book. They're not chapters. They're not the book itself, right? These are cases that I feel I get sufficiently deep into in order to make the point that I want to make about anonymity. But they're really, it was narrowed down to a few pages per case. There's a lot of depth in those few pages. But from a methodological and a practical perspective, each one of those cases was weeks and weeks of reading and weeks of writing. You know, of course, like everybody, you read a lot more than what you need to read because you got to become saturated. You know, you have to make sure that you've hit the literature sufficiently. Every case that I get into was its own little mini research project. And it became apparent to me very early on that if I wanted to write the book that I wanted to write, that I had to do that. And all of a sudden I realized this is going to take a lot longer than 1 year. And so, you know, unfortunately, I didn't have the presence of mind, which I should have had, to just accept that. I think I'm in a better state to do that now. I'm kind of sick of stressing out about this stuff. But at the time, possibly exacerbated by the pandemic and other matters, and the feeling like I had lost some publishing time doing that administrative work, it started to weigh on me. And so part of the experience, as intellectually rewarding as it continued to be, at every step it was intellectually rewarding, it was also very stressful and anxiety provoking because it was growing in ways that I didn't predict. And I felt like I was losing a little bit of control over that part of the process. And everything worked out, and I'm very, very happy with the final product. But I just want to be honest about the process, because I think it's not uncommon for people to experience that in academic work, and it's rarely talked about. Often advisors act as if their graduate students should just pump their dissertations out, or, you know, there's stress involved. There are unforeseen turns in the road. There are life circumstances. And all that was as much a reality for this book as it was for other projects. But the other side of it is that I got to read a lot. I got to get into a lot of different literatures that I would have otherwise never delved into. And I became really fascinated by a number of scholars out there that inspire me. Like, I remember I was looking at, you know, I dedicated a whole standing bookshelf to books that I was reading for this project, and I would keep them organized and stacked high according to different chapters and different sections. And one day I was looking through that bookshelf, and it occurred to me that if I was explaining, you know, if I was walking through that bookshelf with somebody else, every book would be a book that I would say, this is a book that you have to read, right? Because there were so many inspirational colleagues that we have that have written amazing work on stuff. Somebody I didn't mention with regard to the Ku Klux Klan, Linda Gordon's book. I write about the death penalty and lethal injection in chapter 4, David Garland's work, Phil Smith's work. You know, I write about drone warfare. There's an anthology of critiques about military technologies written by and organized by anthropologists that was just absolutely, you know, some of the work in there was just hugely illuminating in that regard. And I could go on and on and on about, you know, with regard to Anonymous, the hacker network, Gabriella Coleman's work on Anonymous, just absolutely fascinating ethnography of that network. And I could go on and on about like all of the inspirational literature. I should also mention, by the way, Gary Marks, who is a scholar who most recently published an excellent book on surveillance, Windows into the Soul, but also wrote a trailblazing paper and published it in 1999 called What's in a Name? A Sociology of Anonymity. And it was a short little paper, but he sort of pointed in to a lot of the directions that I explored. And so his work was in some ways foundational. And then his later work on surveillance, again, that part of the process to me, if it wasn't for my own pressures that I felt with regard to getting the work out there, with regard to doing it right, but discovering that it was a much bigger project and all of that, that was the most rewarding part. Like I felt like I became a better scholar in the process. I felt like I now have arms that are reaching out into like dozens of subfields that I never would have associated myself with before. All of that made me feel like a more mature scholar at the end.
Well, I'm glad you shared that with us because it is an issue that a lot of us face in terms of finding the boundary for our work and sort of deciding what's in and what's out in terms of even the scope of our questions sometimes. But I will say these sections that you're talking about where you condense a lot of information or, you know, use an example for just a few pages, the main text of the book, for those who don't know, clocks in at 178 pages, which means that De Gloma has been incredibly concise in the examples and making the points at the depth that they deserve, right? At least that's my take.
I appreciate that.
On the book, because I walked away with it being much more informed about these cases, even things that I had heard about, but hadn't really had the time or ability to investigate. So the book's recommended for a variety of reasons.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I'm glad to hear that's the case.
It's a packed read. It's not a difficult read, though. You know, it's not a slog. I don't want to give people the impression that, you know, it's so densely packed that you can't sit down and enjoy yourself reading it, because I think you certainly can. You mentioned earlier that, you know, you've got these chapters organized with the different kinds of anonymity, from anonymity that works for or against social change, anonymity in service of government objectives, anonymity that characterizes everyday bureaucracy and routine interactions of commerce and community life. Chapter 4 on the anonymity of social systems or within social systems, you know, really stuck with me. So as sociologists, we're used to thinking about social institutions and systems as collective actors. So how does thinking about these collectivities from a perspective informed by anonymity help us understand them better?
Yeah, this is all, you know, again, I love this chapter, and it's so very different than the rest. The central point of this chapter is to investigate the ways that large or technologically complex social systems mask the personal identities of the actors behind them. And this can occur at a number of different levels. But the idea here is that when we perceive institutions and social systems to act, which we do, we talk as if, we often speak as if, banks or states or corporations or social movements are the actors behind certain actions, it liquidates the personal responsibility of the individuals whose personal identities are hidden. It liquidates their responsibility and their accountability, creating a framework where they can do and often are prompted to do things that they would not otherwise do if their personal identities were more exposed and more attached to their actions. And language here is key. We often speak as if these institutions and systems have agency. So let me refer briefly to a couple of the cases. There are five main cases in the chapter and lots of subcases, but one of the ones that I discuss is the 2008-2009 housing market crisis. The press around that time is full of examples of the ways that people say, well, the big banks did this. Wall Street was the actor behind this. When we speak as if big banks are acting, or if Wall Street is an actor, it further obscures the persons, the people behind the financial actions that brought this crisis about. It obscures their personal identities of the people who have profited from it, and plenty certainly profited from it. But we then focus on the banks as the actors involved with the crisis. And there was an interesting divide I found very clearly, and I feel I sort of support this with my analysis and with the data, that when it came to homeowners whose homes were foreclosed on during this crisis, millions of homeowners lost their homes. Homeowners are spoken of with an ethic of personal responsibility. We apply an ethic of personal responsibility to the homeowner who failed to pay the mortgage and who lost their home consequently. And therefore, there's also an ethic of personal liability. They are liable for their decision to take out a mortgage that they ultimately could not pay. When it comes to the financial actors, especially those in the mortgage industry that peddled all of these, you know, subprime mortgages, these, you know, graduated rate mortgages that ultimately led to the collapse of the housing market, we speak of them with an ethic of institutional responsibility. Who's at fault? JP Morgan Chase. Who's at fault? You know, we speak of the institution as being responsible, and an ethic of socialized liability. We all remember the phrase, if we were around then, too big to fail, right? The liability is shared by the society. The liability is shared by the taxpayer. So whereas homeowners, personal responsibility, personal liability, with financial actors, it's institutional responsibility and socialized liability. There's a contradiction there in the ways that we think about the responsibility and accountability of the actors involved, and the anonymity afforded by social systems feeds into that. The press around the time also kind of illustrates that, you know, you have these profiles of homeowners who lost their homes, and these homeowners would be named in these stories. They'd have, you know, personal names would be out there, and they lost their home, and this is how it happened, and tell these stories, which are heartbreaking in many ways. But the persons that they would be up against would not be persons at all. It would be Bank of America or some other financial institution. So it creates a contradiction in the ways that we perceive responsibility, agency, and the ways that we hold accountability on a social level. We can also look at very different cases. One that I examined that is disturbing on an entirely different ethical level and political level is the case of the evolving technologies of war, and in particular, the technologies of distant killing. The case can be made that for centuries, soldiers at war were anonymized because they were part of a collective front, a military that was represented by the symbols of a nation or symbols of a religion, whatever it might be. And that collective front sort of anonymizes the soldiers who become blended into this collective, right? But it's still the case that for many centuries, soldiers were physically confronting each other on battlefields, if not with handheld weapons, with guns that did not have any degree of accuracy beyond a limited range, so that, you know, that's the Civil War, you know, saying that we hear sometimes, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. It was a very close quartered type of violence and killing, which even if individuals are not named to one another, it personalizes it in a certain way because you see the effect of your killing. Your work, you see the suffering, you see the death if you're on the battlefield. With the evolution of distance killing technologies, you know, really starting with long range guns, but, you know, evolving rapidly throughout the 20th century to include the dropping of artillery or the launching of artillery from some distance, the dropping of bombs, including atomic bombs from airplanes. And then, you know, most recently with the technologies of drone warfare, the distance between those who do the killing and those who are killed increases radically to the point where, and I take a fairly close look at drone warfare, it depersonalizes the entire act of killing. It makes it anonymous on a whole different level. So the person being killed is anonymized and appears as an avatar on a computer screen to the operators of the drone. But even more so, the operator of the drone is completely anonymous to the person being killed and to the community of the people who are targeted. So that sometimes the drone isn't even seen or heard before the strike. So the explosion of the Hellfire missile and the knowledge of the drone becomes the front of violence for the victims. That becomes the face of whatever country it is operating the drone. In the case of lots of examples, it becomes the face of the United States to Pakistan, to, you know, Yemen, to countries throughout the Middle East who have been targeted by U.S. drone strikes. The U.S. is represented by these automated technologies that are operated by people living and working thousands of miles away who will never be seen, who will never be named. And so there are consequences to that in terms of how killing proceeds, in terms of the ethics of killing, that the system anonymizes the actors. And we can, again, see it in the language, in the press. You can find articles, you know, using Google searches, referring to drones as if they have agency. Drone kills this and that. You know, I think I cite one where it says Obama apologizes after drone kills so-and-so, right? In the case of the aid worker and the children who were most recently killed in Afghanistan, you know, drone strike kills, as if there's this technological agent in the sky that's firing missiles. The more correct way to say it, I think, to attribute agency in the proper way would be to say a person uses a drone to kill. But that's not how we speak of it. We speak as if the technology has the agency. By the way, the same thing holds for AI today. I've been thinking about engaging that somehow, writing an op-ed or something. It's under the title of "Be Careful How You Speak About AI Because It Matters," right? We often speak as if artificial intelligence is acting on its own. It's not. It's being employed. It's being programmed. It's programmed by people to do things, and it's used by people to do things. Yet we speak as if AI is its own agent, and it's not its own agent. It's very much a tool, and the drones are very much a tool of real people who are doing very real killing. So the technology allows for this distance. Greatly enhances the anonymity of killing and has a lot of moral and ethical consequences. And then finally, without being too long-winded about this case, because it is also carries a tremendous and weighty number of moral and political issues and considerations, is the case of lethal injection. Very briefly, in the wake of mounting concerns about state executions in the 1970s and accusations that executions were unconstitutional because they violated the Eighth Amendment and protection against cruel and unusual punishment, doctors in Oklahoma, the state medical examiner and an anesthesiologist at the University of Oklahoma, developed this technique of lethal injection to execute condemned prisoners. And that's the technique that's been used by and large in the large, large majority of cases of state executions since that time period. But in most states, you know, in order to perform that procedure correctly, you need the assistance of medical professionals to do it. Unlike other techniques where anybody can flip the switch or release the blade of the guillotine, this is a medicalized procedure, and the entire system behind it has been medicalized. And in order to ensure that doctors will participate, in order to get them to participate, states typically promise them anonymity. So they're often anonymized behind the act. And in some cases, states have made it illegal for anyone to expose the identity of a doctor or any other execution team member. And there are criminal and civil penalties that are associated with this exposure. So there's some deep protections around the personal identities of medical professionals who participate in executions. And one of the things that it does is that it prevents us from scrutinizing the credentials of the individuals involved. It prevents us from holding them accountable, but it also creates a perception that the act itself is sanctioned by doctors, as if the medical degree is what we need to know. There's a doctor behind the scenes administering this dose of lethal chemicals to kill this person. And so the doctorness of the person is foregrounded, but the personal identity is backgrounded. So we see the generic medical credentials, the symbolic capital associated with an MD or some other medical degree. And that symbolic capital of the medical industry and all of the ethics involved with medicine and all of the procedures involved with medicine and the cultural significance and the coding of medicine as a space of care, as a space where pain can be alleviated, all of that is used to frame the execution procedure as humane. So the anonymity of these doctors, their participation in their anonymity, allows for the promotion of a public perception of humanity that's associated with execution. And I discuss other aspects of that too. And, you know, all of them are deeply troubling. But, you know, in all of these cases, the housing market crisis, case of distance killing technologies, including drones, and the case of anonymous execution teams, we end up saying that states and nations and banks do things because the actors behind them are anonymized either officially or just simply practically anonymized by the systems and the way that we interact with them. And it leads to a very noticeable lack of personal accountability that is troubling, and I think one of the central factors behind the social problems that are associated with each one of those cases.
I think another implication of your work concerns the anonymity in social systems and its effect on our civic life. So you make an argument about how anonymity affects our sense of community and democracy. So can you say something about how the anonymity of public and private institutions can erode public trust and democratic engagement?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question. And I don't think I weigh in on it on one side or the other. But I will say, having written this book, that I've walked away from this book with a great respect for personal accountability in a democratic sense. I believe that as an organizer and an activist, as somebody who's chaired a democratic body, you know, at my college, that there's something to be said for personally claiming responsibility for your ideas and your actions and for having a political and a democratic sphere where people can and should do that. The problem is that it's not always safe for everyone and that power sort of gets in the way here. People are experiencing all over the world various degrees of oppression, facing various threats that are incredibly real. So what anonymity does in those cases with regard to political participation is that it frees individuals who would otherwise not be able to participate. It frees them to participate. One of the cases that I mentioned are Saudi women who went online and in some cases on Twitter anonymously to protest the system of male guardianship in Saudi Arabia. Had they done that with fully exposed personal identities, they would have risked persecution, very serious forms of persecution. And there are plenty of other cases where anonymity serves this very valuable protective purpose. But that's not to say that it shouldn't be the case that women from Saudi Arabia shouldn't be able to personally claim those ideas. It's to say that they can't and that they ought to be in an ideal world, but because of the way power operates. So power in that situation is the problem. The powerful actors who are doing the threatening are the problem that require the anonymity be associated with resistance. In a world where we achieve equality, where equality is a protected principle, then we can speak of, I think, the necessity of always openly claiming personal identity to attach your ideas to your personal standpoint as a matter of principle, because ultimately that's what a democracy should look like. But until our democracies are equal places and spaces where people don't have unequal risks involved with speaking and acting, then I think anonymity will always play a very valuable protective purpose. Another interesting point that I want to raise, though, is that when people use anonymity for protective purposes, they're not only performing while protected, so they not only get the cover that allows them the freedom to express themselves in the way that they would otherwise not be able to express themselves. They're performing while protected, which liberates them to say the things that they would otherwise not be able to say out of fear of retaliation. But whether consciously or not, they're in some ways performing their own need for protection as well. So an example of that is when social movement activists go out into the street in contemporary New York and wear Guy Fawkes masks to engage in a rally. To some extent, they're saying that we need to hide in order to express ourselves. And in part, they're also creating the conditions in which they need to hide to express themselves, associating that form of expression with hiding. Now, if it is the case that those individuals are deeply threatened and run great risks by exposing their personal identities, then it might be understandable, but in some cases, there might be a more valuable impact by publicly claiming our ideas personally, because without fear, we're out there claiming the democracy that we ought to have. And in hiding, there are certain times, I think, where we undermine it. But I think interpreting that is a case-by-case process, and it involves a lot of complex variables and factors. So the point here is that anonymity is both protective and subversive all of the time. And in some cases, it can provide a valuable freedom that's necessary to effect positive change. But in other cases, it can provide a cover that allows for the circulation of harmful ideas or the promotion of the notion that freedom of speech should be a hidden phenomenon. And it can actually erode democracy in the process. So the last chapter of the book is titled The Contradictions of Our Hidden Identities, because I don't see any clear answers one way or the other here. I see it being a very complicated matter that needs to be dissected on a case-by-case basis in order to understand fully. And every time anonymity offers protection to somebody who needs protection to speak and their ideas are serving a progressive cause, it offers protection to people who are expressing hateful ideas too. Every time the subversion of a norm is done so in a way to make society more egalitarian, the subversion of norms might be done so to make society more unequal. So anonymity in and of itself is neither good nor bad, but how people use it, like just like any other technology, how people use it, I think, is the matter. And that's why it's a very valuable topic for sociology, and in particular for sociologists who are concerned with getting to the roots of the cases that they study.
Answer here makes me think about the power of public stances and Coming Out Day, for example. So the very public declaration of a minoritized sexual identification is often seen as both an empowering moment, and part of that empowerment is Rejecting the stigma that comes from having been hidden or having hidden oneself, that aspect of one's identity. Tom, I think we could talk a lot more about all of this, but I want to turn to something that's related to what you said earlier about forms of oppression and who gets to speak and threats to public engagement for our maybe less on the light side banter segment of our conversation as we're moving towards a close. But what are your thoughts, as someone who's studied anonymity and people's public performances of anonymity or pseudonymity, in our current context where it seems like academics who study racism, white supremacy, trans folks, people who have those identities themselves are being identified, you mentioned doxing, targeting of various kinds. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so the phenomenon is that largely aided with digital technologies and social media, repressive actors, typically among the right, are targeting faculty and attempting to harass them for their ideas or their identities or their scholarship, whatever the case might be, and sort of publicly shame or threaten them into silence. I think it's horrifying. I think it's an attack on the fundamental character of our institutions of higher education. The right wing has always hated higher education because it is one of the most progressive and democratic institutions that we have, and it always has been. It's always been the place where new and amazing ideas, not all ideas that come out of higher education are new and amazing, but it's always been the place where new and amazing ideas are born and where the seeds of social change are nurtured. And so it's not a surprise that it's under attack, but the way that it's under attack by targeting individuals today is somewhat at least enhanced by the technologies of digital media, which also, by the way, allow for the anonymity of many of these attackers that hide behind organizational fronts or pseudonyms or place anonymous threats. And we see that happening all the time. What do I think needs to happen for it? I think that publicly as an institution, we all need to come out against it. We all need to support the colleagues who are targeted and attacked. It needs to be a coordinated defiance of shame, defiance of silence, and a mutual support of the type of open, free communication of ideas, of academic freedom, of free speech, of debate and dialogue that are the cornerstone principles for our colleges and universities. We need to become as deeply and openly committed to those principles, more so than we ever have been, in defiance of these attempts to silence our colleagues. I've seen it at my own institution, and I've seen it in ways where a colleague is attacked and nobody comes to their support, and people act like it's not them. And, I think it needs to be an open and public form of support every time this happens, because it is an attack on the institutional principles targeted towards an individual, which can be totally horrifying for that individual, by the way. And we need to support them on that level as human beings in support of somebody else who's being unfairly targeted and harassed. Certainly, we need to support them. But we need to support them also with the understanding that this is an attack on scholarship and the principles of higher education and the institution of higher education, and that the reason that it happens is because the ideas are strong and that they're sound. And just like activists who are faced with threats from COINTELPRO, it would be a mistake to retreat out of the fear that's understandably caused by this form of harassment. It would be a mistake to retreat from that, because the objective is retreat. The objective of the attacker is to get you to retreat. Instead, the tools of the spotlight and the tools of collective support and always falling back on the principles that we hold, you know, dear in academia, that will cause it to become insignificant, and that will expose it to be the paper tiger that it is. And so, you know, that's where I stand. And if anything, your question serves as a reminder to me to double down on those principles whenever I hear of something happening like this, because it's absolutely vital. And in general, let me say also, Dan, that I think there's no better time than the present to understand that we need to cultivate a positive culture of higher education when faced with all of the threats that we have in the world, but especially any attack on higher education, which those attacks are taking a variety of different forms. We need to understand that the institutions that we have are our greatest strengths, and start to use them to create the world we want to see. Part of that involves defending our colleagues when they're attacked, but part of that involves acting proactively to really build the world the way that we want to see it built.
Well, that was a beautiful response, Tom. I think I don't have much more to add. Thanks so much, Tom, for your time and for writing this really engaging and excellent book on the performance of hidden identities, as the subtitle says.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Thanks to our guest, Tom DeGloma, to Joe Cohen, the director of the Queens Podcast Lab, and to our editors. Music by Lena Orsa.